I don't think we put Sharon's name in the program. So it's Sharon Hendrick. Is it Hendricks? Okay, so this is Jade's mama, Sharon Hendricks. Yes. Yeah. That was so beautiful, and our band sounded amazing too. Wow. Yeah, I was a little worried we might have to take those flowers back, you know, if for some reason. No, it was good, because Joan prayed for you to be good, so, you know, that's it, yeah. All right. So, headed in the right direction, yes, I like that. I think we are, as a spiritual community, I think we're headed in the right direction, because in the last, I don't know, 6 months or so, I've seen kind of an upgrade happening, right? An upgrade in terms of the level of service that we're providing to our homeless brothers and sisters through the valiant efforts of Lucky Lynch and her team, and being able to see how we're reaching around the world and all kinds of things. And you know what? As Jade and her mom were speaking, Jade and Sharon were singing, rather, I was thinking, what is the right direction? Really, if I could put a principle to it, what is the right direction? And to me, today, where I am with this message, to me it seems like the right direction is humility. I've been contemplating a lot because of having been in India earlier this year, and also writing a blog about a gentleman that I met there. I've told you about him before. He was a man who lived in the public toilets in the slums and then found his way out of the slums and started being a craftsman, making brooms. And just the experience of meeting him was so profound for me. And I asked Nipun, what could I do to show my respect? And Nipun said, touch his feet. And so I knelt down and I touched his feet. And that was such a heart-opening experience. And it really made me think about the idea from the Christian gospel that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. You know, and what does that really mean? You know, in the past, I think people have believed, and people have even taught me, that it means that, you know, you have to be poor to get into heaven. And it's not about that at all. And then I was thinking, well, is it kind of like in, you know, in Costco when you're in a really long line and somebody comes along and says, you know, I see you just have a bag of industrial strength odor eaters and a vat of ketchup. Maybe you can come in this line, you know? And what a good feeling that is to get to be first all of a sudden. But I don't think it's that at all. I think the last shall be first and the first shall be last is about humility. That's what I think about it today. That could change at any time. But it feels like when we are humble, when we are surrendered, we are open to receive the kingdom of heaven, which is among us all the time. The kingdom of heaven that is at hand, the kingdom of heaven on earth. When we allow life's challenges not to not build a wall of armor around us, but to humble us instead, where we can open up and say, what is the gift in this? That immediately catapults us into the kingdom of heaven, where we can grow and grow and grow and learn and really start feeling that kingdom of heaven that is all around us all of the time. Some may ask, what is the kingdom of heaven? And in this teaching, we say that it is a state of mind, that it may be someplace that you go after you pass over, but it's also right here. It's a state of mind. It's a state of being. And I thought that the reading that Hugh did was a beautiful illustration of what that is. And for those of you who might be listening to this in the recording or didn't hear the reading for some reason, the reading was basically about that love is like an ocean, that we often say that love and fear are opposites, but beyond love and fear, there is this ocean that contains everything. And it said that the fear is like a shark that is something that's just swimming in the bigger ocean. And what I loved about that reading, to take it a step deeper, is that it's also a great analysis of the absolute and the relative. Because, you know, when you look at a shark, you say, is a shark a good thing or a bad thing? And the answer is, yes, thank you. You know you're doing something right when they speak the vision back to you. Most answers here are yes, just so you know if you're new. By the way, would you like to volunteer for some heinous job? Good job, all right. Brock, that means we have a whole bunch of people to go under the church with the cobwebs and, you know, never mind. No, we won't start you off there. But anyway, so the sharks in the ocean, you know, the author called them fear, but they really are relative, because sharks are certainly a bad thing if you're surfing and you see a shark, right? That's enough reason to, like, paddle furiously or, I don't know, poop in your wetsuit, who knows? surfers, am I right? Right? But a shark, in terms of another picture, you know, if you're looking above at the whole system of the ocean, a shark is something that modifies and regulates the ecosystem of the ocean. It kills the little fish so that it doesn't get too out of balance. So a shark is both good and bad. It just depends on your perspective and your position in it. Ernest Holmes, the founder of this religion, said that we do not change the law, or we do not change reality, we merely change our position in it, right? So the ocean is this absolute that contains everything, and some of it we might label good and some of it we might label bad, but really the key to heaven, I think, to being in the kingdom of heaven, is to identify with the ocean, to identify with the absolute that contains all possibilities. In that way, we can see the gift in everything that is offered to us. We can see the perspective. We can hold the opposites and allow them to reconcile into something brand new and wonderful for us. And in holding these opposites of the ocean, the goodness in the ocean and the badness in the ocean, and that I identify with the source of all, which is the ocean, right, in this scenario, in this metaphor, the third or the fourth that came up for me was that not only do we step into the ocean, the kingdom of heaven, when we identify with the absolute, but the kingdom of heaven, the ocean, steps into us as well. Amen. Thank you, Brother Chris. It's like Rumi said, you know, that we are all drops in the ocean, but every drop contains the ocean as well, right? So that's a powerful yet challenging place to navigate from. It doesn't feel quite right to the ego, so sometimes we slip out and we come into this either-or consciousness, but then when we are able to step back and recognize and identify with the entire ocean that holds all possibilities, then we move much more into a yes-and consciousness. Yes and yes consciousness. And that is what frees us. That is what creates heaven on earth. That is what allows us to be and remember that we are one. I am remembering who I am. Means that I am remembering that I am one with the love that encompasses everything. Now, remembering and feeling it in your heart is one thing. The other thing is that we need to embody it. And the way that we embody it is through service. Recently, when I was back in India in January, I felt like I stepped into heaven, and heaven stepped into me. And I have to be careful about saying, well, that was just there and this is here, because this is also heaven on earth. But the thing is that we are dealing with infinite principles here, and I think that we can be even better at representing heaven on earth and loving one another and being that place where we feel the essence of the absolute moving through us, that we may ripple it outwards to everybody around us. And so I looked at my experience in India, and I tried to come up with a formula as to how they created what they created there, because it was really quite magical. And the top three, there were lots of things, but the top three were that they listened devoutly to everyone. There was a devout quality of attention in the listening. That they focused on the small and inner transformation. We were all taught to have insight and to take complete responsibility for what was happening to us. Very much like this teaching. And the third thing, the one that I'm going to talk about today, was that they were exquisitely proactive in looking for opportunities to serve. Not only were they exquisitely proactive, they were over the top relentless in looking for opportunities to serve. So I don't know if this story is church-friendly, but I'll just go for it. Okay. So an example of that was I was passing conversation with some volunteers. We were about to go to a shrine, a Hindu shrine, and I was wearing American clothes, and I just said, I wonder if I should change into clothes that look more traditional, more Indian. You know, would that be a sign of respect? And they didn't really say much about anything, so I went into my room to get ready. I was in the bathroom, and then I hear knock, knock, knock on the door. I said, come in. She comes in. Not only does she come into my room, but she comes into the bathroom. I wasn't doing very much, by the way. I was just getting ready to. But anyway, she comes into the bathroom with this Indian vest. She's like, this is for you. You commented that you didn't have any Indian clothes. It's not really what I said, but you commented that, and I want to give this to you. And I was like, what's her name? Drishti, that's so kind of you. But is that your vest? No, I bought extra Indian clothes so I could give them away. And so she gave it to me, and it turned out that I couldn't wear it because it was a jacket, and it was a vest jacket, and it was too warm. But then the next day, I found this red, long Indian garb on my dress with matching pants, and I was like, I'll bet that was her. And she denied it, but I'll bet it was her. But that's what I'm talking about, a passing comment. You know, a passing comment leads to giving, leads to service. You know, and as I've told you before that in the eating situation, in the mess hall, that's not what it was called, but in the, let's call it the prasad hall, holy food hall, we would eat, and you could just feel the volunteers watching you, and you'd get up to wash your plate, and they'd be like, bam, 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 coming over, I'm going to wash that plate from you. So, you know, and I actually see that here all the time. I see evidence of people doing proactive acts of kindness all the time, proactive acts of service and goodness. The one that springs to mind today is someone I forgot to ask permission to talk about her, so I won't say her real name, but she may actually work here as the office manager, so we'll just call her, we'll call her Jeanette, okay? And it's not I don't think the other Jeanette is here. It's not the real Jeanette, it's a fake Jeanette, and I know you can't. But anyway, one thing that I've noticed about Jeanette is that on her days off, she goes to thrift stores, and she has it in her heart and in her head so many things that people have said to her over the week, and she often buys presents that match somebody's needs or somebody's desires. What really tipped me off on this was Jennifer Merlick. Is Jennifer here? I don't think Jennifer's here today. But anyway, Jennifer is a drummer. She's the leader of our drummer circle, and Annette came in one day with this thing on her desk. It was some type of a frog. It was a frog with like scales on it and a little stick. And she's like, I got this for Jennifer so she can hit on it and make percussion. You know, who thinks of that? Who goes to the coalition and thinks of that? You know, but that's part of Annette's ministry. Hi, Annette. Oh, Jeanette. Hi, sorry. Yeah. So it's stuff like that, and it can bring you a lot of joy because, you know, sometimes when we do these talks about service and we're saying serve more, serve more, serve more, look for relentless acts of kindness, look for relentless ways to serve in a radical way, you know, people are thinking, oh my gosh, I do so much already. Last week, I facilitated a phone call. This is hilarious to me. The people at Service Base, Nipun Mehta's organization, asked me to facilitate a phone call, an international phone call on burnout. Like I'm an expert, you know? And I told them, you know, that's hilarious that you're asking me because, you know, I guess you teach what you need to learn or you learn what you need to teach. I'm not sure which one it is. I think the answer to that question is yes. And and it'll be mostly questions and not so much answers. But what I learned from that call is that I was speaking to somebody a woman in Turkey who's the daughter of a dervish, her German Protestant husband, a man in Japan who has a dojo, an Indian doctor, so many people from all over the world, and every single one of them felt like they had too much to do. And every single one of them felt like their to-do list was like a hydra, you know, where you chop off a limb and like six more grow onto it, you know? And we looked at that together, and we decided that, we discerned that possibly the reason for that was a sense of futility, like I'm not doing enough, so I have to do more, what I'm doing is not working, or just a general sense of not being enough somehow. And I think that the way to address that is what I said before, in terms of Gandhian values, is to really focus on the small, focus on small acts that are enjoyable for you, and that may stretch you a little past your comfort zone. But focus on the small and then trust the ripples. When I was in India, there's a story that one of my colleagues spoke about. Her name was Shaheen, and she worked for a group called Teach India. And she brought a bunch of kids, about 50 school children, young school children, into this ashram. I believe it was Gandhi's ashram. And she brought them in, and there was a man there named Jayesh Bhai. He was the host of where we stayed, and he was related to this man that I've spoken to you about before, Ishwar Patel. He's his son, actually, and Ishwar Patel changed the face of untouchability in the city that they live in by providing dignity and work. It was Gandhian principles and all. And anyway, so this woman brought these 50 school children to Gandhi's ashram, and Jayesh Bhai was there because he facilitates a lot of stuff there as well. And when the kids came in, they, of course, took off their sandals, because that's what you do in India, and they just threw them in a big pile because they were kids. They were young kids. And Jayesh Bhai just went and put all the sandals in a nice row. Shaheen, my friend, their teacher, came out, and she said, "What are you doing? They need to learn how to do that for themselves." He said, "Well, let me just try it this way for a while." The next time they came back, same thing. The kids ran in. They threw all those sandals in a big pile. Jayesh Bhai came by and said, "I'm just going to put these in a row." Shaheen again was like, "They haven't learned yet." And then the third time they came, and the kids went to put their sandals down, and they put them in a nice row without being told. In that situation, all it takes is for one child to recognize, you know, it's a lot easier to find our sandals when they're in a row. It's a lot kinder to our colleagues. You know, it's a lot more aesthetically pleasing. Not that they use those words, but it's a lot prettier when they're all in a row. And I think of that in terms of service. I think of that in terms of service is that if we keep doing the small acts over and over again, eventually it will catch on and it will become viral. I read something the other day from this idea exchange group that I'm in, and one of them said, his name was Thomas, and he said he was going to speak about his patron saint, Doubting Thomas. I love Doubting Thomas. He's like my favorite. I like Doubt. You know, he had to stick his hole in, what, his finger in Jesus's, what was his hand? Oh, his side, okay. Okay, so I'll get too graphic there. Okay, so I love Doubting Thomas because of that. And this man, named for Doubting Thomas, said, "There is doubt, there is fear, there is persistence, and the greatest of these is persistence." And perhaps Jesus did not rise on the third day, he rose on the third try. Now that, of course, you know, having my mind brings up, you know, images of, you know, snooze alarms and whatnot, like, and then a little bit more, and then me, 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 and then, all right, already, I'm getting up. Note to self, maybe do not blend Jesus with Shemp from the Three Stooges next time.
Note to self,
yeah. Yeah. But it kind of works, doesn't it? This idea that we have to try over and over again with the right intention, with the right attitude. You're making me laugh over there. With the right attitude, and ultimately something shifts. It really is the 100th monkey syndrome, right? Or what's that called? 100th monkey principle, where the monkeys are washing their food, they train the monkeys to wash their food, and then when you get about around 100, the monkeys automatically start washing their food. That's what we're doing here. And the laughter is because I implied that you're monkeys? Is that what it is? Okay. I apologize. If you knew how fond I was of monkeys, you would not take that personally. The same thing goes for pigs, okay? I love pigs, too. Okay. So, you know, what does this bring us? You know, because, I mean, certainly the service, we have the joy of service and the joy of helping the world and the joy of seeing the world transform through our small acts of service, but it also really helps us in a huge way. It transforms us in an amazing way. And what I find is that through service, we suddenly, and this is another really important thing, is why this thing that I participated in India worked so well, is that we become extremely sensitive to recognizing the connections that we all share. I have a connection story. It involves people who go to the church, and I have gotten their permission to use it. And it's rather touching, so I'm going to jump into it. As many of you know, one of my best friends passed away about 2 weeks before I went to India. She had a sudden and a tragic death. And we had been friends for 40 years. It was time to do her memorial last weekend, and I was concerned about, because of my own sadness, I wouldn't be able to show up and be the person I needed to be to hold the sadness of others. So I asked our beautiful practitioners to pray for me, and they did. That was on Friday night. The memorial was on Saturday. I woke up on Saturday morning. I walked up Sulphur Mountain, and all of a sudden I knew exactly what I needed to say and who I needed to be. I didn't only ask the practitioners too, I asked a bunch of the teams I was working with that week. So the prayer grounded me in who I needed to be. And I knew that the service was going to be about love, pure love. And emblematic of this idea of pure love are these hearts that we distribute that are made by the women in the slums of India. And so we gave everybody who attended the memorial a heart. And then it gets better. 2 days later, I was walking with my friend's husband, and he asked me if he could have a heart that was partially unsewed so he could put some of his wife's ashes in there. The metaphor of the broken heart was not lost on me. But I decided to write to the women in India because, okay, we make these hearts here. We're still not quite as good as the India sours. I decided to write to my friends in India and see if they could send us some hearts that were not completely sewed. In the meantime, there was another loss in somebody in the church. Our beloved friends, a couple of practitioners, their dog and the wife's grandfather died on the same day, within 9 hours to the minute of each other. And so I asked them, you know, this idea has been planted in my mind. Would you like a heart to put ashes in so that you can carry with them with you always? And they said yes. And then Annette gets wind of it, or Jeanette. And Jeanette, who has this way of seeing beyond appearances and can see needs before you even articulate them, Annette said, I'm going to get some little receptacles to hold those ashes so they remain intact. And you know, I could see that in Annette because of Jennifer Merlick, who's our drummer, and Jennifer Merlick was here because of Todd, who lives over here right now. Todd is our former choir director who lives in Boston. What?
Boxborough.
Okay, thank you. And then I heard back from the women in India, from their leader, Meghna is her name, Meghna Banker is her name, Meghna Ben, they call her. And she said that the women in India were beside themselves with honor that somebody wanted to wear the ashes of their loved ones in one of their hearts. That it was the first time anybody had ever asked for that. And so I wrote back to everybody. I connected Jeff and Jen and Greg, who are the couple who lost their dog and their grandfather, and connected all of them, and connected them with Nipun, and connected them with Meghna, and Audrey, who was one of Nipun's helpers, and just wrote about what a beautiful thing this was, really, that we could all see these connections, and that all of these connections were happening. The practitioners who prayed, so that inspired me to give the hearts in the first place, you know? All of these beautiful connections are happening right now, and how good it is to be able to see them. And they all agreed, and they all were just over the top with this beautiful, beautiful scenario that was going on behind the scenes in the invisible world, and then I didn't think it could get any better, and then it did. Because when I spoke to my friend's husband about it again, he emailed me and he said, you know, I can see Debbie, my wife, sitting in one of those sewing circles in India, and she's laughing. And my friend Debbie, who delivered thousands and thousands of babies in this area, in Ventura and in Los Angeles, who traveled to Nepal to work with the poorest of the poor to deliver their babies, who when she was a teenager built an orphanage in Africa, sitting in a sewing circle with women in the slums of India is just a mere hop, skip, and a jump, and it is so perfect for her. And it proves to me, I mean, first of all, why not? And it proves to me that even with all of these visible connections that we make visible through our consciousness and through our awareness, that the invisible connections that we do not see are infinite and just as powerful. And so I'm grateful for your listening to all of that, and grateful for allowing me to express that, but also even more grateful in advance for all of us developing the eyes to see and the ears to hear and the hearts to know these beautiful connections that exist everywhere and connect us and become for us the kingdom of heaven, which is wholeness. There is nothing to be healed, only wholeness to be revealed. There is nothing to be healed, only the kingdom of heaven within and without to be revealed. And that is our sacred joy here. So you get to look at how you're going to do this in your life. And if you don't have any idea how to do that, we'll help you. In fact, we may even have a service opportunity for you here. At least one. So as you've noticed, perhaps, if you've been coming here regularly, one of the things that I'm doing lately, you know, one of the challenges of ministry is to get people to take these concepts and have them hear it on a Sunday and then actually incorporate it into their lives. So I've been having people come up on the stage and talk about a five-minute miracle of how did you use these principles in your life and how did that work for you. What I'm going to do today is another way of engaging more of the congregation, because we are in the process of developing an improv team. We're calling it Yay Improv, Yes and Yes Improv. And I'm going to have three of our improv team members, Susie Thatcher, David Kerrigan, and Rita Nikloff, come up, and they're going to help me illustrate how you can use these principles in your life. A little spiritual theater for us, okay? Thank you, Brock. Appreciate it. Just on far left, yeah. Oh, good job, you guys. Okay, I have to read this, and I'm going to sit down here. You may not be able to see me, but I'm unimportant in this, okay? So, here we go. You remember the rules? Okay, so the rules are is that when I look at them, they start acting stuff out. They're not allowed to talk, but they start acting stuff out. And occasionally I'll ask them to freeze. Or occasionally I'll, like, get the hook, I don't know. And we'll see how it goes. Okay, here we go. There was once a man who wanted to know the difference between heaven and hell. So God came to him and took him down a long hallway. There were two doors across from each other. God took the man into the first door. A pot of stew was in the middle of a large table. It smelled delicious. But the people sitting around the table looked malnourished. Okay, now you work. Malnourished and unhappy. The man noticed that the only thing they had for utensils were long spoons. The spoons could reach the stew, but the handles were so long that the people were unable to feed themselves. And freeze. Hold that thought. You hold that thought too. A few weeks ago, we decided to reinvent our hospitality team, our coffee hour after the service. We assembled a team of superheroes. And freeze. They are analyzing our coffee hour like scientists. Scientists. And freeze. They are designing new sexy aprons. Because service is the new sexy. And freeze. We decided to call hospitality Team Prasad. Prasad means holy food made with love. And they're doing it already. We want to engage the congregation in feeding each other. And freeze! Now, of course, change can be challenging in a church. I spent some time worrying about what could go wrong. We're asking the congregation to bring food. Will they do it? Will the congregation starve? Will the church crumble? Will Annette and Bonnie lose our jobs and wind up like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford living on the wheelchair ramp, feeding each other dead rats? Freeze! Give us a moment in this freeze to remember the truth of infinite possibilities. Oh, yes, possibilities. From this new perspective, we trust. This new program will be an inspiration. After the service today, people will rush to sign up to bring food. In the social hall, it will be a sign-up cattle stampede. Freeze! When it comes time to serve food and or clean up, everyone will jump in. There will be a tug of war over to see who gets the plate of cookies. Freeze! Getting to wash dishes will be like roller derby. Okay, freeze! The people will rise up and serve each other. Now, we're still frozen, people. Take a moment to remember the image of hell that I spoke about before. People with long-handled spoons, unable to feed themselves. This is hell. Freeze. And as you might imagine, hell has just frozen over. Heaven looks different. God brought the curious man into another room. The room was exactly the same, stew in the middle of a large table with long-handled spoons nearby, but here, the people looked happy and well-fed. I'm sure you know why. The people were happy and well-fed because they were using the long-handled spoons to feed each other. Yay! You can keep feeding each other as I finish up. Your willingness to practice here, feeding each other, creates heaven on earth. We hope you join us in the sign-up cattle stampede! Just go to Stanley's Hall after the service and look for Ethan? And Yvonne, and a lady whose name I don't know. Your help will bless you, will bless all of us, and bless the entire world. Namaste, the entire world. Namaste. Thank you very much. And please be